One, two, three, four.
One of the biggest symbols of America is Mount Rushmore, this monument, right? But I think most people fail to realize where it's located and why it's located there, and even more importantly, who did it, right? So one, it's on a sacred Native American mountain, right? A place where this was central to their creation stories. But then you think about who did it, and it was a Klansman. The guy who sculpted Mount Rushmore was a Klansman. People are like, wait, really? Like, how is that a thing? And it seeps into our understanding, our embrace of white supremacy. This whole notion of us using Mount Rushmore as a metric of excellence. And so it's really sad that we're honoring slave owners and people who killed natives viciously and people who pillaged other lands in the name of capitalism. And that's what America is, I guess. I think there's such a disinterest in education in America that is sickening. We can't even agree on facts, you know, where it's like, well, it's up to states' rights to decide. It's like, really? States can say that this is true in one state, but it's not true in another, although these are states united. It's very bizarre. I'm hopeful for a revolution. I'm optimistic. I want radical change. I think we are repeating history. We're going through a cycle of fascism and greed. And I think we're going to see a lot of states collapse. As a result of that, I think people are going to be forced back to their primal needs and concerns, but I think they're going to be forced to think about what makes us human. Like, how do we become more human? Because we've lost that. We've given it up to technology. How can we figure out what makes us a really powerful species again?
Irvin Weathersby Jr. is a Brooklyn-based writer and professor from New Orleans. He is the author of In Open Contempt, Confronting White Supremacy in Art and Public Space. His writing has been featured in Lit Hub, Guernica, Esquire, The Atlantic, Ebony, and elsewhere. He has earned an MFA from the New School and an MA from Morgan State University. He has received fellowships and awards from Voices of Our Nation's Arts Foundation, the Research Council of CUNY, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, the American Council of Learned Societies, and the Mellon Foundation. Irvin Weathersby Jr., welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you. Such a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm excited to discuss In Open Contempt, your new book, Confronting White Supremacy in Art and Public Space. It's so timely and important, bearing witness and asking questions and also giving answers of how we can go forward. But before we dive into the conversation, perhaps you could just tell us first about where did the title come from, just for those who don't understand, because I found it so moving.
Yeah, so the title comes from a Frederick Douglass passage. So in Frederick Douglass's book, The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, he describes the moment when he realizes that he is actually a slave. And in that moment is actually when he is going to be sold on an auction block. You know, he actually, before that period, was taught to read by his master, actually befriended his master's son. But when his master died, he had to be sold along with all of his other property. And in that site where he witnesses the auction block, he remarks that, you know, how are we held in open contempt of our humanity, reduced to beasts and swine like cattle? And in that moment of realization, that epiphany, he recognizes that we are hated so viscerally and so openly. And I use that title really to try to convey what it means to be a Black American, or at least really honestly, a Black person, I think, who inhabits Earth and many countries where it seems as if white supremacy has shaped society for the past six centuries or so. And these moments of hatred often rear their heads in many locales.
Yeah, indeed. And in many ways, as we see around the world, slavery has been outsourced to other countries or wage slavery, which is really unfortunate, terrible tragedy and trauma that continues. Before we go into the conversation, I believe you've selected a passage to share with our listeners.
Yeah, so I'm going to read from chapter 6, which is entitled A Day in a Life of Chains. And this is a passage wherein I'm actually touring a museum in Louisville, right? When I entered the Speed Art Museum, I had an unobstructed line of sight to Breonna Taylor, like she was waiting for me at the back door of a long shotgun home in New Orleans. As I moved through the galleries of the Promise, Witness, and Remembrance exhibition, inspired by her life and others killed in the war, I anticipated our meeting, wondering what she would say as I drew closer to her with each step. The words "We the People," drawn by Neri Ward, occupied an entire wall in the first gallery, displayed as a droopy calligraphy of colorful shoelaces. Inspecting them up close, I realized they dangled freely from hundreds of tiny holes drilled into the wall, like an incredible game of connected dots. A few well-placed tugs could easily dismantle the tangle of threads, which I know is true of what the words signify. Flawed in its foundation, the image makes you remember that the promise of America came with conditions. The metaphor of a nation tripping over its laces as it marches forward is too obvious, suffering one injury after another, sprained ankle, scuffed knee, broken wrist, minor setbacks for the white masses that amount to devastating losses for we, the not people, or three-fifths people, or whatever other calculus they devise to strip away our humanity. The wall text described the artworks in the room as representations of a nation and its promise. And I scanned the gallery until my gaze landed on two flags flanking the entrance. Each appeared to be replications of the American flag without its red and white stripes, just the blue space of endless stars hung from poles braced high upon the wall. Created by Hank Willis Thomas, the flags are part of his Fallen Stars series, which memorializes the lives of those killed by gun violence in 2019 and 2020. I looked to the flags again and saw how they pooled into expansive folds, as if burrowing into the floor, the depths of our family's trauma defined as a never-ending abyss. How many stars will populate the next, I wondered. At the other end of the room, I inspected an untitled bust of a black soldier sculpted by Ed Hamilton. The soldier wears an empty expression, his face a mass of goatee and cheekbones. He is neither victorious nor somber, but steady, his eyes shielded beneath a Union Army forage cap. He is one of our great-grandfathers, one of the more than 200,000 black men who fought for the Union. And I made it a priority to see him in D.C., where Hamilton erected his entire frame as the first monument to honor his fight for our freedom. I turned to the neon sign on the adjacent wall, November 4th, 2020. I didn't need to read the wall text to know that this was the day after the election. I remember the uncertainty of the moment, how in the aftermath I felt uneasy about the results, with so many ballots left to be counted and a loser contesting the outcome before it was certified. Glenn Ligon fittingly titled it Aftermath, nodding to all the turmoil brought on by Trumpism and the hope that we would someday see the end of COVID and its variants. I remember that 2 months after this date, a retired servicewoman was shot while trying to breach the Capitol, her death the result of a confused patriotism animated in a world wherein whiteness possesses unconditional impunity, somewhere beyond the rule of law that kills us over loose cigarettes, counterfeit currency, bootleg CDs, wide nostrils, and other myths ascribed to blackness.
Yeah, and those encounters with art as doorways into another time, sometimes artworks, whether they're contemporary or historical, really bring you back. You can just feel their pain and resilience. Mm-hmm. Of course, you address those monuments that are not sympathetic, not portraying them as we the people. I like that phrase very much. We the not people, we the three quarters people, or we the half person of limited rights, of limited humanity, and why it's necessary to either remove them or, you know, explain them too, so mm-hmm. that history is actually, look at the whole story of what this represents.
Absolutely. You know, and I think there's actually a spectrum of what could be done with these monuments, especially these races and these very complicated, controversial monuments, right? The first is obvious, you can remove them, right? But we can also relocate them to certain spaces, whether they're inside museums or cemeteries. We can repurpose context to what these people represent, what the times they represent, and really how that speaks to the present moment. So I think all of those are potential options of dealing with these monuments and really trying to reimagine our future.
And yes, and so what is it like? You're from New Orleans, you now live mm-hmm. in New York, but you really address, what is it like to, of course, New Orleans had this moment of mm-hmm. reckoning with the monuments, but it also was the focal point of the slave trade. What's that like facing that history and just knowing all the pain, the suffering that passed through that port as you trace it up the river into different regions mm-hmm. touched by the slave trade?
You know what a fascinating thing is, I think, about human nature is that often we take for granted the things that are around us. I think it's easy to kind of live in the world and not necessarily focus on your location until you leave it. And then you have a moment of comparison, right? And so I grew up in New Orleans, and I was very aware of hatred all around me. So in my youth, David Duke, who was the former Grand Master of the Klan, was an elected official. And he, along with other politicians and other leaders in the community, openly espoused hatred. And so it wasn't at all a surprise how they felt about us, right? But then when you leave New Orleans and come back and you recognize how New Orleans was central to the birth of America, it, in many ways, kind of overwhelming, a little alarming to really think like, wait a minute, I'm from this place that was so significant. And you can feel the culture there walking through the French Quarter, and you recognize the Spanish architecture, you recognize the native influence, and you obviously recognize the African influence. And so you have all of these things working together, and then go back into history and you recreate what this place was. I think it was both fascinating and overwhelming.
Yeah, exactly. But sometimes when you're born in it, you don't fully recognize it to see it, the leaving and, you know, coming back. Mm-hmm. Revisiting these places. And, you know, you talked there about the election of Trump, and we're facing now with the second Trump presidency, the rolling back of DEI. We had all these wonderful, hopeful moments with Barack Obama, but then sometimes I feel like there's regrets, because sometimes if you go, and this is a terrible thing to say, but if you go too quickly, too fast, and get too much recognition, there's, on one hand, people who are so progressive and open, in some ways that can kind of inspire this backlash, which is really sad. I hate to say it, like, you know, don't go too fast, or, you know, kind of don't make an issue of your successes, because it makes others, the continuing white supremacy that's kind of hidden, come out again.
You know, I'm of two minds with that. I think that you're right, that sometimes the speed at which change is so conspicuous creates this equally and maybe even more powerfully conspicuous backlash. However, I'm selfish in the way that I want to live the best life I can while I have it, right? I think everyone deserves that. I think every human at every age deserves to live the best time that they can, or the best life that they can. However, I'm also aware of what my ancestors have said and what they have endured, and recognize I have a lot more freedoms, albeit they're still limited, albeit they're still encroached upon. I'm thinking of Kwame Ture, and I'm going to paraphrase something that he said. Ultimately, yes, our ancestors were enslaved, but we have an opportunity to really try to do the best that we can and do it as perfectly as we can to set up the next generation, because change in many ways moves slow. If you think about it in a very simplistic way, in America especially, if you think about 3-4 centuries of hatred and oppression, and you compare that and juxtapose that with roughly 60 some odd years of freedom, and freedom is in air quotes, right? It would seem that you would need more time to right those wrongs in terms of trying to kind of balance the scales.
Yeah, and there's so much to take in at this very charged cultural moment. I mean, we just saw yesterday, you know, President Trump seems more attuned to what he calls a genocide of white South Africans than, you know, suffering in other places around the world that can be legitimately called genocide. You know, and he's just touting some of these conspiracy theories as though they were truth. I just find that so dispiriting. There's the people, the we the people, and then there's those who are not quite people. I'm continually shocked at this presidency, and yet knowing that you have to work with it because you have to kind of come to understanding. It's very difficult in this time to be an activist, I think.
You know, I don't disagree with that. I think, look, he is never, or at least he hasn't shown us that he's going to be any different. He's actually only going to double down on his ignorance and his unthinking and his uncaring. Look, if we're really going to drill down on these South Africans, we're talking about 59 people that he's offering refugee status to, but it becomes so symbolic. And I think that is another kind of thing that I'm getting at in this book, right? When, you know, some people have said, well, these are just symbols, these are just monuments, like, you know, are they really going to affect change? And I think, yes, they are, you know, because I think this is really affects consciousness. And, you know, whether it's your conscious mind, your subconscious mind, it affects our behaviors. And because he is believing some lie, and maybe, you know, I don't know if it matters if he believes the lie or if he's just espousing it, but it's clearly, you know, unproven that these people are being persecuted, right? There's so much objective data to suggest that he's wrong, but it doesn't matter. He's in a position of power. And what I would argue to conjure some of the ideas of some other ancestors, some other revolutionaries, some other radicals, I would think of what Angela Davis often said in terms of, look, like this system, this experiment of democracy has failed. We need another way forward. I truly believe that representative democracy is not representative. There's often not ways in which we can directly impact our goals. You know, once we elect these people, then they have a right to do what they want for the next 4 years, right? They can lie to us. They can steal from us. They can use their positions of power to gain wealth in the stock market openly. And what recourse do we have? You know, there's some places that have these referendums, these structures where you can create a referendum and remove a person more immediately. And I think that is what we kind of need. I truly also believe in something that's more egalitarian and something more altruistic, where every U.S. citizen or every citizen of every country has to figure out a way to participate in the civic discourse, whereas everyone has to potentially serve as an elected official as a part of your right being a citizen, right? It rotates, you know, or some sort of other creative way in which we can all get more people engaged in the political process.
Yeah, I had a really interesting conversation with James Fishkin, who runs the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford. And you may know about these movements. He's done different deliberative democracy around questions in different countries, whether it's about climate change or different things with their legislation. So I'll share this link with you, as I think a lot of people aren't informed about it, is that they convene these small groups of people. Now AI, which AI has its problems, but you can also train like an AI moderator. It gives people, just average citizens, a chance to deliberate, and you give them facts, non-politically sourced, just facts. They get a real sheet that they can really understand and discuss, and people change their minds. People, you know, double down or whatever because they, you know, are fully informed. And you can vote on this. So I think that that is really that fine-tuned, the sense of what I think a democracy should be. This voting for a president or, you know, that's important, but you're actually usually voting for a conglomeration of issues. And one candidate doesn't necessarily represent that, and they're playing on emotions more so than the facts. So I think that's a really interesting way, and it is being scaled up with the help of technology.
I think that is the way forward, because we live in a system where politicians are openly suppressing the vote. They're openly encouraging people not to vote or making it more difficult for people to vote so they can retain their power, so they can get a small slice of the population voting on their positions, which I think is really ridiculous. If you take a step back, I think 10 years from now, or maybe even not that much further in the future, a couple decades from now, people will look back upon us and think that we had lost our way and it was so obvious. I think we're going to be ashamed of ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's an imperfect union, as they say. Yeah. You talked about there, but people say, oh, well, the monument doesn't mean much. You know, there's all these counter arguments. But it's the tip of the iceberg because it's a symbol. You write about how places can wound. So it's not just the monument, it's the place. It's whether you're valorizing this person, this perspective of history. And that has so many reverberations. It's not just the thing that you visit at museums or you pass on the street and don't look at it anymore. It goes into our, you know, it's who writes the history books. So it's a whole ecosystem. And whether we have one that is socially just or whether we have one that it's very skewed to support certain narratives.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, it goes even to the whole notion of America's, I think, one of the biggest symbols of America is Mount Rushmore, this monument, right? But I think most people fail to realize where it's located and why it's located there. And even more importantly, who did it, right? So one, it's on a sacred Native American mountain, right? A place where this was central to their creation stories. It's almost like going to Jerusalem and saying, hey, look, we're going to, destroy this land and we're going to put our faces here on the monuments, on your landscape. And obviously, you know, I use that example because in many ways that is happening, right? But then you think about who did it, and it was a Klansman. And when I tell people that, and then they're like, wait a minute. The guy who sculpted Mount Rushmore was a Klansman. People are like, wait, really? Like, how is that a thing? And it seeps into our understanding, our embrace of white supremacy. One of the things that really annoys me about the willful ignorance of Americans is this whole notion of us using Mount Rushmore as a metric of excellence, right? People often is like, oh, well, who's on your Mount Rushmore? You know, this list, your top four. And every time you say that, you are really re-injuring Natives, Black folk, all those people who were killed to erect this. And so it's really sad that we're honoring slave owners and people who killed Natives and people who pillaged other lands in the name of capitalism. And that's what America is, I guess.
Yeah, it goes on beyond that. We do have to rewrite those canons, have a reckoning with those monuments, those works of art, to broaden the conversation. You approach white supremacy not as a singular identity, but as a system of beliefs and behaviors. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's difficult for those who aren't able to face that. In some ways, it's done by their ancestors. They aren't directly involved in creating those injustices, but they benefit from it, right?
Absolutely.
Is there like a risk of collapsing racism? Like, it's, oh, good and bad actors. How can we do that so that guilt, it's not forcing people to take sides in that way where they feel complicit in things that they weren't complicit in, but yeah, face the history nonetheless?
Well, yeah, I think oftentimes when people are injured, it becomes a non-starter when they feel like they're being attacked and like, look, I'm not a racist. Like, I do this, I do that. And they can point to a bunch of other things. And then the conversation ends. They're like, all right, well, look, I've already proven that I don't espouse white supremacy. And that's not necessarily true because I think we're all guilty. I think white supremacy is so effective that it's infected us all. And I think what we have to kind of also, I think, meet in the middle and say, look, this is an issue that we all face. Like, this is has confused us all. I think the biggest thing, at least for me, when I approach this, for anyone really, is that I first say, look, all humans are redeemable. I truly believe that. I don't think anyone's born to hate each other, right? We are all way more alike than we are different, right? I think we operate there first. Then I think what we can do is to say, well, look, I unfortunately espouse some of these white supremacist beliefs in these ways. You may espouse some of these beliefs in these ways. That doesn't necessarily make us good or bad people, right? All humans do good and bad things, but it's not that simplistic. We're all complex. We're all layered. We all have been affected culturally by white supremacy. And so even for a person like me, whose community still struggles with colorism, or when you think about places in the Caribbean, the long ongoing conflict between the Dominican Republic and Haiti, or you think about all places, even in Latin America, right, where, you know, what is favored is still the white European model, even places in Asia, right? All of these things still affect us in ways that we may not necessarily be aware of, and we may be injuring ourselves even when we think we aren't. And so I think we could just take a step back and really just do an inventory of what are some of my beliefs that are actually tied to white supremacy.
Sure. I think that the legacy today is not, you know, for people of color, but who benefit from the kind of cultural and economic dominance that America, Western European, you know, has on the world. I mean, when you think about it, America is still less than 5% of the world population, but it's such a dominant player. And it goes back to like the rest of the world outside of this English speaking or American Anglo society. Oh, they're the others. They're the ones who they can, you know, make our iPhones or make our shoes, but pick our fruit and things. And, you know, we all benefit in different ways that we are
absolutely
lucky to be born in America. I was born in America, though not living there now.
Yeah, we have to
remind ourselves of this because it's hard to think that America is less than 5% of the world population. And so you have the BRICS nations, which are now over 55% of the world's population. Mm-hmm. Europe says, you know, 12% of the world population. So we have to enlarge our view of humanity. I mean, if you were able to travel around the world, there would be so many other monuments around the world.
Yeah.
Legacies, right?
This is a global conversation that is happening in Asia, in Latin America, in Africa. People are taking these monuments and these contested sites to task. Because I think whether it's apartheid, Columbus, and Western expansion in Latin America, people are starting to understand, like, this is not a great representation of us.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about channeling your voice, how you developed your writing voice. Mm-hmm. You write very movingly about your grandmother and that kind of storytelling tradition. I mean, just to anchor yourself within the traditions, whether it's your family or those writers that you admire, what you are aiming for. How do you tune into that?
After talking to people and doing some more reflection, I think it's very clear to me that my upbringing in the church has a really outsized influence on my writing in terms of the Black oral tradition. Every Sunday of my youth, I was in a church, and I'm not necessarily overly religious now, but the music in the church and the actual sermons, the words, the actual Bible, all of these things were cataloging in many ways. Right. As you mentioned, my grandmother was very formative in my writing. She noticed very early on that I had an interest in reading and writing, and she fed me books, information, and really encouraged me in ways that I didn't really know what was happening. It's really bizarre now that I have kids and be able to see that distance and that connection between me and them, and to think about this woman and to see her connection to me and looking at this little boy who had an affinity for words. You know, it still amazes me that she gave me so much. I was very fortunate enough to be born in the 80s during the explosion of hip hop, which was incredibly formative in my creative process. I think it's hard to really quantify what it felt like to see Black identities, masculinities, feminine identities, all of it and everything in between, really articulated every day on screen and on the radio in this poetic form that really spoke to us viscerally. Like this music was produced by us and for us. And obviously it has been consumed by the world over. Now at that nascent kind of moment when it was bubbling up, it was electric. It just felt so incredible to kind of hear people that you understood articulating your own expressions and your own feelings and where you came from. And then you grow older and you realize like, oh, you know, you hear your parents' records and you hear music from the 60s and the 70s, and you go further back, and then New Orleans is huge in jazz. And so I actually played the trumpet when I was a little boy in elementary. And so music was always a part of just my understanding, like the logic of music and just being able to kind of understand celebration and culture in that way. I was so fortunate to be born in that milieu. But when it comes to writing as a professional, and as I kind of got older and really started to understand my gifts, I always lean in on the poets. I want everything that I write to read like a prose poem. Poets are the people who always inject flair and imagination and creativity to my writing. While I often go to their poems, especially, I think the sweet spot for me is poets who write prose. When I read their works, that is what I'm trying to recreate on the page, whether it's Claudia Rankine or Elizabeth Alexander or Natasha Trethewey or Hanif Abdul-Rakib. There's so many of these poets, Ocean Vuong, so many people that have influenced me in terms of the language and the lyricism. And even you just think about Baldwin and his syntax and the complex sentences that he would write and the way he was able to maneuver time to be in the present and the past and the future at once. I truly think that in many ways is unique to Black culture, but is also replicated in other cultures. And so when you think about Native American writers or Latin American writers and how they blend time. And so all of those figures really kind of speak to me. And, you know, even one of my favorite living writers right now, I've read all of his work, is Mohsin Mohammed, Pakistani author. Really, really love how he kind of manipulates time and language and how he infuses his own culture, but also brings everyone else in. These are just a few of, I think, the things that kind of influence the way I write and want to write and the way I want to read, ultimately.
I think that that's so true in terms of music and poetry. I mean, there's the meaning and then there's the music. And a poet told me that we are poetry. And I thought that that was a nice way of thinking about the human experience. We put meaning on things, but like when we dream, When we're who we are in our silent moments, I believe you meditate too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you do tend towards poetry and lots of things that we try to ignore in our professional life, but that's there. It's kind of bubbling up underneath the surface.
Always there.
I mean, it's the source of our beautiful moments and also our illogical and angry ones as well. There's something that we can't explain.
I think meditation, whether it's prayer, walking meditation, just looking at nature and engaging with those things, it allows you to transcend. I mean, if I can go back, some of my favorite transcendentalists is Emerson and Thoreau, and how they were able to go in nature and experience a shift in their perspectives.
Yeah, it's true. This nature is also a monument to our humanity. That's another thing that we're trampling over. We have a One Planet podcast. Speciesism is alive and well. We don't consider all this we share our planet with as much.
I'm here for it.
Yes. Just tell us a little bit more about some of those artworks that inspired you in the writing of this book, but just in generally as like kind of your touchstones.
Well, you know, I will bring up another musician, Christian Scott Atunde Ajuda. He's a horn player from New Orleans. And he plays jazz, but he has changed what that really means. He has really kind of expanded that definition. He calls it like creative improvised music, right? He calls it stretch music that includes all forms of music together, whether it's African music, whether it's hip hop, whether it's traditional jazz, and other sounds to kind of fuse and create something that's unique, something that is whole. And I think that is a part of my process. It always has been. Before I even knew I was writing a book, I was always a student inspired by art. If you are going to be an artist, you have to consume art. I tell my students all the time, you can't be a musician who doesn't listen to music. You always need to be reading more than you're writing, even when you're thinking about art and even visual art, whether it's film, portraiture, murals, landscapes, or whatever. I was fortunate enough to be very attuned to how these things were working in my subconscious and conscious mind. One of the more formative experiences for me that really solidified my relationship with visual art was the first publication I wrote. It was a biography of John Biggers, arguably the most important African-American muralist ever. In the process of writing this biography, I was able to tap into his inspiration, the people who came before him, whether it was Charles White or some of his other contemporaries, Elizabeth Catlett, and all these other people. And I was able to get a greater sense of what art was doing for my community, for my culture, and why it was significant, and get a greater sense of value of it. That was very early on in my writing career. And fortunately, it was actually my first byline, which was paid. I didn't necessarily seek this opportunity out. This was actually given to me by a professor. I truly believe in the universe conspiring to push you forward, serendipity, whatever you want to call it. I truly believe in those forces aligning, astrology or the stars, and all of this working for our benefit if you are pursuing your passions purely, right? I think that is, in many ways, the story of my life, finding one work of art and allowing that to kind of push me to the next one. Whether as a young man really engaging with the revolutionary work of Spike Lee and Do the Right Thing, and how formative that was in terms of seeing these people who looked like me from my community engaging in conflicts that were familiar to me, right? And, you know, just those types of things that it's hard to take for granted in shaping my creative practice and my creative catalog, as it were, are the things that I pull from regularly.
Some legacies are carved in stone. Others are scratched into vinyl, looped in breakbeats, and tattooed on memory. In open contempt, Irvin Weathersby Jr. asks us to look closer at the places we praise, the monuments we pass, the institutions we let speak for us. He reminds us that Mount Rushmore, like other monuments, isn't just a mountain. It's a monument to erasure, a land dynamited and drilled into the faces of men who built a nation on stolen land and stolen lives. And yet, when statues of slaveholders come down, the outrage is loud. When monuments to oppression are questioned, people scramble to defend them, but not to mourn the absence of the stories we left untold. There are no towering tributes to the millions who were enslaved.
No marble arcs for the stolen children. No markers at the bottom of the Atlantic where slave ships sank with names never spoken again. As Weathersby writes, the denial of justice has become so common that the grief becomes ritual. A grief passed down like heirlooms, worn quietly, but deeply felt. This is what happens when we honor power and silence pain. When we protest the removal of statues that incite violence, yet do nothing to address the absence of memory for those who were violated. Places can wound, and it should be addressed, and has not been. But the story doesn't end there. During the hip-hop boom of the 80s, Black voices re-centered the narrative. Through turntables and rhymes, communities wrote themselves back into history. They left messages on tape decks and street corners, art that couldn't be bulldozed or censored. And as Weathersby reflects in the podcast, this language, this lyricism, allowed Black creators to, quote, maneuver time, to be in the past and the future all at once, unquote. And that's where I find myself too. As a Black woman, I've often turned to poetry and writing to carve out my own space, not just to express myself, but as a means for my own survival. To process pain, yes, but also to make room for joy, softness, and safety. I seek out the places where Black safety is amplified, where we aren't just seen, but held, where our grief isn't just endured, but honored, where legacy does not mean a statue, but a truth that refuses to be buried. Because every time we speak, create, write, we leave a monument behind, one they can't tear down. And now, back to the interview.
Oh, that's so interesting. I think, you know, one thing inspiring the next and allowing that path to open and just trust and following that. It's actually the spirit of jazz in a way. You don't come with preconceived, back to that tradition of the improvised, of being alive to the moment, which is the spirit of jazz or hip hop or whatever, just listening more than imposing your preconceived ideas on things. There's like two, like there was a conversion of past. Like we've had the written word revered and the oral tradition, which I love, but oral tradition historically has been by many demoted. Like, oh, it wasn't written down, therefore it's not of value because no one bothered to write it down. And it's so weird because you've written about, you know, native traditions or indigenous traditions. And there's others who think like they mistrust things that are written down. You mean it was written down? It's not living language then. It's not sacred anymore because you actually killed it to commit it to that way, you know? So it's so strange.
It's very fascinating. Even thinking about Crazy Horse, right? And and that indigenous tradition of that really distrust in photography and portraiture. Right. This idea of like, if you capture me on this frame, that my soul somehow is going to be captured on that canvas or within that frame or that landscape. And so, look, I think it's a really fantastic idea in the sense of how people shape meaning about their lives. I think another thing that has allowed me to kind of think creatively is I'm really into creation myths, fascinated by the stories that people tell themselves of how they got here and the belief systems and how they shapes people's identities and morals, and just really trying to be a student of the world and other cultures and recognizing like what that means for me and them. And like, how do we, where is the point of connection? Where is the overlap? Where is the humanity that we share in all of them? And I think it's really inspiring when you can start to piece those things together. Like, oh, wow, you know, most people actually believe that we should be kind to each other. Most people value certain animals and nature. If we can kind of get back to those things and figure out ways of how to kind of talk to each other and not be so greedy with salvation, I think we can get somewhere greater.
Yes. And you ask important questions about art and museums and institutions as well. I mean, we're now also at that moment of reckoning with museums, where so many of them are built on the legacies of extraction, exclusion, and exploitation. We want to go to museums to learn. So many museums are just built, their collections, most of the things in them don't belong to them, or they're not from their country, not from their culture. So how can we reconcile that? I'm all for this repatriation of art when possible. At the same time, you know, there's complex issues about that, whether that's always possible. But, you know, how do we do that? And then to be respectful, because sometimes they just, you know, it's like the product of looting, and they just gathered all this stuff and then they put it together and they didn't belong together.
Exactly.
The Acropolis situation is very sad, but I mean, there's so many stories like that.
So many stories across the world where people are still fighting to be like, hey, look, can you give us these things back? Can you give us these remains of our ancestors back? Can you give us these artifacts? I think it's a very bizarre thing in human nature to want to catalog and categorize and to other the unfamiliar, right? And sometimes the othering results in a diminishing, and sometimes it results in propping up of things that maybe are not as valuable to these other cultures, right? You're holding on to this utilitarian pot from X century that was just a tool. And now you have it in some museum behind a glass case when in many ways that wasn't what it was intended for. And what is the real purpose of that, right? And so look, I believe in archaeology. I believe in anthropology. I believe in the whole notion of trying to understand our past. But to what end? You know, what is the real goal behind museums that are still holding on to these artifacts? How could they not just necessarily be repatriated, but how could they be more honorific of these cultures? How can we, whether it's direct payments of, you know, based on the number of people entering these spaces, or how can we repair these sites of damage when they were looted from? It's a very complicated thing because, you know, I think we know a lot about Egyptian culture based on people excavating the tombs. And that's fascinating. That's cool to kind of see now. But is there some sort of calculus where that's appropriate? You know, does X amount of years have to pass, or how do we, you know, honor these people at the same time, but still having it on display for educational purposes? You know, so it's one thing to have some sort of notion of like, look, this is my intent. I'm trying to use this for educational purposes, but then there's still an impact. And so how do you reconcile the two? Like the impact still could be injurious, even if your intent is not. And so these are large questions. I mean, even the whole notion of what a museum is, I think should be in question. I think the notion of the value of art and how that is artificially kind of based on who says it's valuable. If X amount of billionaires say that this is worth 20 million, then people will give you 20 million for it. But you can see even currently now, the value of certain art is diminishing. I've read some articles recently about Black portraiture increasing after the death of George Floyd, but now the prices are decreasing significantly. And so, you know, people are not as interested anymore because they're not as moved by trauma, as it were.
Yeah. And then you see it as a kind of artistic reparation in terms of, we're not going to see it as an asset class and yet not invest in the kind of social and educational programs that communities might need. We're going to support a handful of artists, which is nice and symbolic and makes them feel well and also increases in value. But it doesn't address the issues that a lot of these artworks are really about.
Yeah, I think that's the rub. I think that's another thing that artists, museums, curators have to figure that out. The artist Titus Kaphar often talks about this. He had a really awesome documentary called Shut Up and Paint. And in this documentary, he describes that feeling of feeling valued, feeling like, yeah, my art is worth something, people are paying handsomely for it. However, the people that I'm actually featuring, the subjects of my art, cannot purchase it based on the value that it has risen to. And as a result of them not purchasing it, oftentimes they can't even engage with it. So art that I am creating for these folks is largely invisible to them. It becomes this incredible kind of existential thing. Like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? I think many artists are kind of facing that, where the work is now, as you said, seen as these assets to build wealth. But where does the artistic practice lie? Where is the value in that? And how is that transferred to others?
And as an educator, you know, of course, so many things are changing now. We're in many ways, at most educated generation, and yet so many young people are facing uncertainty. And I know also, I believe your son is neurodivergent. You must have a lot of reflections on education for him and just for among your students.
Yeah, you know, I am an engaged parent. I'm an engaged educator, and I'm concerned due to AI. You know, we saw just recently that a journalist or the Chicago Sun-Times was outed for writing an article about books that didn't exist, or a summer reading list full of books that didn't exist. And people were reading it and like, well, wait a minute, these things don't exist. It's really kind of like funny, but not, because it's really sad to be a person who produces art, a person who cares about words and labors over them, for someone to really just haphazardly click a button and almost devalue what that process is. And so I'm really disheartened by the valuation of critical thought, critical engagement, critical writing. As a professor who teaches freshman English, I'm terrified. I really am, in terms of what am I going to do to encourage people to actually use their own brains to produce something. You know, I think many of us are at a loss. Thinking about my own son, because we have so many books in our home, he's a voracious reader. And I think, you know, empirical data has across cultures suggested that the more books you have in your home, the better you will be are as a human. And so I think that is my goal in life. How can we learn to engage with art again? I think there's such a disinterest in education in America that is sickening. We can't even agree on facts, you know, where it's like, well, it's up to states' rights to decide. It's like, really? States can say that this is true in one state, but it's not true in another, although these are states united. It's very bizarre. I'm hopeful for a revolution. I'm optimistic. I want radical change. I think we are repeating history. We're going through a cycle of fascism and greed. And I think we're going to see a lot of states collapse. As a result of that, I think people are going to be forced back to their primal needs and concerns, but I think they're going to be forced to think about what makes us human. Like, how do we become more human? Because we've lost that. We've given it up to technology. How can we figure out what makes us a really powerful species again?
No, I think it's so true. And I think that we're at this threshold, and in the past, when you talk about having the work done by others, talking about the legacy of slavery, if we give that all to these digital minds that are becoming faster and smarter than we are, we do lose our humanity. It's so true. And a lot of people can't tell the difference, but it's heartening and also tragic that I read that a majority of university students now are saying they wish the internet wasn't invented. I mean, that's not even AI. That's just the internet. They don't know what it's like not having the internet. I didn't know I was living through a golden age of having a childhood without the internet.
Yeah, it's very crazy thinking about technology in that way and to remember what it was like to be pre-internet.
Yeah, but pre-AI is another thing. And I think that we do have to hold on to it because we have to understand what gives our life meaning. Can you imagine? There'd be people who get their AI to meditate for them. And then it'd be done like that. Yeah. So it's the struggle, I think, that does give us our life meaning, that we discover it for ourselves. Then, and that it gives our individuality. I mean, that's my belief. And I think this has been such an interesting conversation, touching on your book, but also just your creative process and your life as a teacher as well. I think that In Open Contempt is a really fascinating book, and it really opens up a lot of really important questions. So thank you, Irvin Weathersby Jr., for bearing witness, confronting the white supremacy in art, public spaces, and monuments, by shining a light on racial trauma and reclaiming silenced narratives. We can face our past and create a better tomorrow. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you for having me.
The Creative Process podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. The interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Jaden Band. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative work for review,
just follow us on Instagram @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.